the end of the 20th century, E.O. Wilson hoped that humanities and science could work together to give us a new, more powerful lens of perception. And he says, "And that is the way I would like to suggest the fiery circle of science and humanities could be closed and creativity in the two branches of learning might converge. Through natural history and nature writing of the kind that may well be emerging into its 21st century form." And so that's what we hope to hear a little bit today. The fiery circle of science and humanities closed, and nature writing in the 21st century. We're going to start with Dutch Salmon, who is well-known and beloved, author of many books. Dutch, if you'd like to begin.
I decided to read from a paper I did a couple years ago for the State Game Commission on native and non-native fish. Rather than being soothing and evocative, it's apt to open a can of worms. But I hope it'll be interesting. Call this the Gila fish dilemma. The Gila forest fish are in the news. Because of the precarious condition of many of the native species, most of which are on the threatened or endangered list at the state or federal level. They're also in the news because the same waters are occupied by competing non-native sport fish, which are slowly being discovered as providing a quality angling destination. For example, noted outdoor scribe Ted Williams, who writes for Audubon and Fly Rod and Reel, has described the Gila River, New Mexico, as the only warm water trout fishery in America. Touching on the same theme of uniqueness, yours truly has opined in several articles that the Gila River, New Mexico, is a world-class fishery, in part because, quote, where else can you catch a wild trout and a flathead catfish out of the same pool? That the sport fish so loved by one constituency are largely non-native species, and at least partly responsible for the decline of the mostly non-game native fish, which have their own defenders, only elevates these waters as interest, controversy, and irony. Well, the principal native fish of the Gila are the long-fin dace, the Gila chub, the headwater chub, the round-tailed chub, spike dace, loach minnow, speckled dace, desert sucker, Sonoran sucker, Gila trout, Rio Grande sucker in Animas Creek, Rio Grande chub in Animas Creek, and the Chihuahua chub in the Mimbres River. And the non-native species are brown trout, rainbow trout, brook trout, cutthroat trout, rainbow Gila hybrids, smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, channel catfish, flathead catfish, carp, black bullhead, yellow bullhead, and bluegill. If you know anything about fish, you know that the first 13, the natives, only one of them is the game fish, the Gila trout. Of the non-natives, all of them are considered game fish and draw the interest of anglers. So that's where the controversy comes in. It's the contention of many that Animas Creek contained Rio Grande cutthroat trout historically. Whether any of this seminal stock survived the fires in the 1950s is debated, but some of the native chub and suckers did. More recently, a large infusion of rainbow trout has left the Animas Creek phenotype increasingly compromised. A series of samplings in recent years by Game and Fish shows the rainbow influence marching ineluctably upstream, and it seems inevitable in time that even the cutthroats in Holden Prong are doomed as an identifiable phenotype. What to do? My suggestion, mechanical relocation of the remaining cutthroat trout to North Saco or Tierra Blanca Creeks, which don't have any fish right now, and replace the cutbows with Rio Grande cutthroat trout from northern New Mexico. In the Mimbres River, the guiding document for fish and game management in New Mexico is the New Mexico Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy. It's over 600 pages. Came out in 2006. In the executive summary, it stated, quote, non-native aquatic species can have considerable adverse effects upon native fish. However, many non-native species have been introduced to enhance sport fishing opportunities. The challenge remains in balancing these interests. So that's the goal, to balance the interests. That's the stated goal anyway. The Mimbres River may or may not have had a native trout historically, but it has two non-natives now, the browns and the rainbows, both presumably in competition with the federally endangered minnow, the Chihuahua chub. What to do? The strategy indicates the first priority action is to, quote, work with state and federal agencies and effective publics to remove the non-native fish. So after stating that balance is what they're looking for, they've decided to remove the non-native fish. This policy lacks balance, in my view. I would suggest they remove the current bag limit on browns and rainbows and manage the lower elevations of the Mimbres for the chub, which is the habitat that they prefer, and the upper elevations for the sport fishery. Next, we have the Gila San Francisco Coldwater Streams Refuge. By one account, roughly 500 miles of trout water graced the Gila San Francisco drainage. About 100 miles of this trout habitat is given over to the Gila trout. We are told that another 50 miles of conversion to Gila trout water could allow a downlisting of the fish from federally threatened to state control. This is all good. These Gila trout waters could yield a substantial cold water refuge for appropriate native fish, Gila trout and others. What to do? Non-natives should be suppressed within this 100 to 150 miles and native fish fostered and promoted, giving a cold water refuge of 100 to 150 miles of stream to the Gila trout and other native fish. And under any scenario, they should stop stocking rainbows in the Gila drainage and convert the Glenwood hatchery to Gila trout propagation. And they should stock these Gila trout widely and often with the long-term goal of self-sustaining populations. I have a suggestion for a Gila watershed cool water refuge. The East Fork confluence marks the end of the Forks area and the beginning of the main stem Gila. The New Mexico Comprehensive Wildlife Strategy that I mentioned before calls for the removal of all non-native species throughout the drainage as a, quote, first action priority. So they want to get rid of all the non-natives in the drainage. This is a judgment lacking balance, in my view. Unlike the colder headwaters, where the removal of non-native browns and rainbows can be compensated by the return of Gila trout, where one sport fish replaces another, if the bass and catfish are removed from the Gila, there is no native sport species to take their place in the warmer waters. What to do? Create a cool water refuge in the Forks area with the removal, as far as possible, of non-natives. We should also create a warm water native fish refuge in the Cliff Gila Valley, from the Mogollon Creek confluence downstream to the Gila Bird area, where the non-native fish would be removed. This is good potential habitat for spiked ace, loach minnow, and round-tailed chub. It has relatively low numbers of predatory non-natives, and the river reach is not popular with anglers due to the preponderance of private land. So we would have a warm water refuge favoring native fish in the Cliff Gila Valley. the discussion. Several years ago, unannounced to the public, Game and Fish and others began the periodic mechanical removal of non-native fish from the Forks area of the Gila River. Rationale apparently was to assess native and non-native fish populations and to see if control of the non-natives would influence native fish recovery. Of course, the fishing therein declined, and when an observant witness reported a large-scale removal effort in the summer of 09, with trophy trout, bass, and catfish banked along the way, the rumored mill took over. Outraged anglers called a local game commissioner to complain, who was myself at the time. It would seem that an agency contemplating the removal of a protected game species that anglers must buy a license to pursue would first offer a public review and rationale to establish transparency and justification for the project proposed. Once underway, it would seem the agency would stock a native game fish, like Gila trout, sufficient to compensate anglers with opportunity roughly equal to that provided by the non-natives before they were taken out. It also seemed that everyone must see the obligation in preventing extinction or extirpation of native species. And it may be that within the Gila drainage, natives and non-natives are simply incompatible, in which case the law will likely favor the natives, and the non-natives may be driven down to a point where the local fishery will be compromised. This approach would be enormously expensive, however, in man hours, direct costs, and the revenues lost with the fishery. And since you would never get them all, the costs and obligations would have no end and might very well fail. Therefore, yours truly believes that the natives deserve a boost, which creatively done will leave them more numerous and wider ranging, even in the midst of a viable, mostly non-native sport fishery. Options I believe might contribute include, summary here, create and maintain a cold water refuge where appropriate native fish will be favored and fostered and non-natives aggressively controlled. This logically would coincide with the 100 plus miles of Gila trout water. Create and maintain a cool water refuge in the Forks area where appropriate native species like headwaters chub and Gila trout will be favored and fostered and non-natives aggressively controlled. Create and maintain a warm water refuge in the Cliff Gila Valley from Mugione Creek down to the Billings Vista, where native fish like spiked ace, loach minnow, and round-tailed chub would be favored and fostered and non-natives aggressively controlled. Maintain a free-flowing Gila River as floods and natural processes favor native aquatic species relative to the non-native species. And also pay attention to the influence of other non-natives like crawfish and bullfrogs to see what effect they may have on native species. And that's my point of view on the native, non-native fish controversy.
Will cooperate for the next 8 minutes. This is a piece in three sections. It's called Mayflies at Maytime. One, forever. Ephemeral, we say of this insect order, Ephemeroptera, an apt name for the mayfly adult whose life's work might take all of a day. The aquatic mayfly nymph, however, grows fat on its stores of time, one or even two endless years. And the bulging universe, this river's shallow backwater pool, whose undulating golds and greens are a dance of plenty. Into the glow and hush steals that pulse of dissatisfaction. For what inspires a life but hunger? There is hunger for food, which the nymphs, streamlined crocodilians on six stout legs, cram into every pocket of their half-inch length. And there is hunger for oxygen, and so the skirts of their gill works curtsy and bow. Viewed from the cobbled shore, the full company of 100 skirted dancers can be seen at once, timed a microbeat apart, thus the tremolo. They contradance and graze their pastures, drowned hulks of rock, the ooze and crumble of the pond floor, twigs and branchlets snagged by mud. They hunker down, embracing food and emulating shadows, then launch themselves, singly or in tentative galaxies, and meanwhile the constant gills flare out, essential and exact and flouncy. The viewer, exhausted from the shimmer and the jostlings, from the charged synchronicities of mutual disregard, seeks relief in observing the stillness of mud. Those silent gashes in the soft bottom muck, those shreds of leaf matter that are not leaves but ponderous arthropod thoughts. The current, at mysterious intervals, carries emptied mayfly skins lopsidedly past, and an underwater plume of mud unfurls to signal something's moved. A nymph, trailing its handsome tail, negotiates the maze of detritus until, at the apex of a figure eight, it abandons this course and goes shimmying through the depths. This is a demanding choreography with scores and scores of everything at once. Heedless, the water rewrites it. Water is creator of the dance, but the pond has its limits. Its northwest edge is a bracket of raccoon handprints, and 2 meters away, along the southeast, heron tracks are laid on thick. Hunger is a restless muse. Water sucks loudly on the rocks. A mud flat cordons off the shallows from the violent river. A ragged spillway between them keeps the pond fed. But only for a time. Not even the banquet of eternity lasts forever. 2. Readiness. The universe no longer fits. What hormonal urges hammer within the mayfly nymph? It trades the soft bed of pond bottom muck for wind-blown towers of rock. Ascending, it slits the skin of water to enter that other boundless universe of air. But first, 5 minutes. The apparatus of the old world must be shed. The new world has already taken shape inside, retailored to fit. Air-colored wings emerge from the coppery, water-tinted suit. A few steps and it's half-in or half-out, half-out-moded and half-brand-new. With a little thrashing, it splits itself open along its back and rears up, flush with oxygen, ready to expand into widened frontiers. Inside-out or outside-in, the skin of its emergent body presses tight against the skin of air. It pushes away its wrinkled fishtail and steps forth with a flurry of wings like a half blast of breath, folds the wings across its new back and waits. An instant or a minute might pass before the full extent of its new tail, perhaps the most elegant touch of all, snaps free. From the finely etched abdomen, it's a delicate upward sweep that is optimism itself. The slender antennae pair of the tail streams out with refinement and clarity. For a moment, the tail tip might lull in the water like a lazy memory, but the mayfly will inch further skyward on the rock and squeeze that much more oblivion behind itself. The river, with all that water and mud, with its jungle of debris, recedes like a cloud shooed away by a breeze, and then the mayfly leaps. It leaps clear out of the picture. Vaporized, apparently. There is that leaping, and then, uniquely ephemeropteran, a second winged molt, perhaps the 24th molt since birth, and the males are swarming beside the river and the female casting herself into the thick of it to mate midair. and now she's back at something like her place of origin, not the shallows to which she as a nymph migrated only recently, but the headlong river itself, there to hover, there to dip her abdomen and plant her eggs and surrender all to chance and water. Into the massive sky she leaps, but a titanic wind hurls her back. What short work it is to create a distant stranger. So recently at home here, now the mayfly drifts on her side, tethered to a raft of sodden wings. When a fly nips down to the water's surface to deliver torment, she's able to counter with a shiver of legs. But otherwise, she has no foothold against the water's designs. She can only wash up on a lucky rock, to climb again, to squirm again, to once again muscle open those wings to the wiles of the new world's currents. 3. Rapture. Deserted garments fossilized mid-gesture. The aftermath of a mass exodus, the look of a massacre. It happened right here, the signs all say. Here, in a shallow backwater of the river, that fevered notion of the rapture played out on the rocks. The soul, or rather the adult mayfly, has sprung loose of its earthly package, that is to say, the trappings of the aquatic nymph, and leaped into the air. Left behind are these wingless husks, clinging with six hollow legs to the upper surface of a stone as cratered as the moon, or paired side by side, head to tail, on a perilous cliff of cobble, or twirling in the water like a carelessly dropped wrapper. One garment was muzzled first by water and then by a contrary wind. Another, hunched forward, seems to soldier on, a conquering ghost. Other ghosts are half submerged and half inflate at the whim of the current. There are those still vertical on the sheer sides of their islands, so near the fresh splash of water that it seems the adults could return, reoccupy their costumes, and replay the drama with a different outcome. The garments will unravel. Spiders will rustle over them. Sunlight will wear them out and wind will flick them away, exhausted memories. As the season advances, as May stumbles into the desert of June, the river will retreat from this shore and abandon the rocks to the weather. And next year, the rocks will have been swept clean. They'll appear to be waiting. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Philip Connors, and he is the author of the book Fire Season by Echo Press.
New Mexico's Gila National Forest is among the most fire-prone places in America, what I sometimes call the epicenter of American wildfire. From a lookout tower on its southern edge, I have a view over a stretch of country where an annual upsurge of moisture from the Gulf of Mexico combines with the summertime heating of the Chihuahuan Desert to create massive cumulus convection and wicked lightning shows. In an arid land with brief but intense storm activity, wildfire is no aberration. It is the forge in which the ecosystem was shaped. Although tens, if not hundreds of thousands of acres are touched by fire here every year, I can go weeks without seeing a twist of smoke. During these lulls, I simply watch and wait, my eyes becoming ever more intimate with an ecological transition zone encompassing dry grasslands, pinon juniper foothills, ponderosa parkland, and spruce fir high country. On clear days, I can see mountains in three states and two countries, the Franklins in far west Texas, the Pinaleños in eastern Arizona, and the northern fringes of the Sierra Madre Occidental in Mexico. To the east stretches the valley of the Rio Grande, cradled by the desert, austere, forbidding, dotted with creosote bushes and home to a collection of thorny species evolved to live in a land of scarce water. To the north and south along the Black Range, a line of peaks rises and falls in timbered waves. To the west, the Rio Mimbres meanders out of the mountains. Beyond it rise more mountains, the Diablos, the Jerkies, the Mogollons, a forbidding jumble of ridges and canyons that comprise the heart of the Gila wilderness. Having spent 1,000 days in my little glass-walled perch over the last decade, I've become acquainted with the look and feel of the country each week of each month from April through August. The brutal gales of spring, when a roar off the desert gusts above 70 miles an hour and the occasional snow squall turns my peak white. The dawning of summer in late May, when the wind abates and the aphids hatch and ladybugs emerge in great clouds from their hibernation. The fires of June, when dry lightning connects with the hills and mesas, sparking smokes that fill the air with the sweet smell of burning pine. The tremendous storms of July, when my radio antenna sizzles like bacon on a griddle, and the lightning makes me flinch as if from the threat of a punch. And the blessed indolence of August, when the meadows bloom with wildflowers and the creeks run again, the rains having turned my world 12 different shades of green. I've seen fires burn so hot they made their own weather. I've watched deer and elk saunter through the meadow below me and pine trees explode in a blue ball of smoke. If there's a better job anywhere on the planet, I'd like to know about it. My office is a 7-foot by 7-foot box on stilts. 20 paces from my cabin, 65 more up the steps of the tower, and just like that, I'm on the job. Each April, after splitting a good stack of firewood, cleaning up the mess left by overwintering rats and mice, and putting up the supplies I get packed in by mule, I begin more or less full-time service in the sky, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., an hour off for lunch. My scheduled work hours are similar to those of any other jogger on the hamster wheel of the 8-hour day, except that my job involves an exquisite intimacy with wilderness, and I ply my trade inside a steel and glass room immaculately designed to attract lightning. It's no wonder I and my kind have been referred to as freaks on the peaks. For most people I know, this little room would be a prison cell or a catafalque. My movements, admittedly, are limited. I can lie on the cot, sit on the stool, pace about 5 paces before I must turn on my heel and retrace my steps. I can study once again the contours of the mountains, the sensuous shapes of the mesa's edges, the intricate drainages fingering out of the hills. On windy days in spring, I turn my gaze upon the desert, a feast of eye on country, if you like your country spare. In early afternoon, I follow the formation of dust devils through my field glasses. Their manic life and sudden death seem to me a fruitful field of inquiry when the mind bogs down in solipsism. Far off on the desert floor, where once a great inland sea bubbled, the earth writhes up in the shape of a funnel. Scorched by sun and scoured by wind, the ancient seabed surrenders itself to points east, eventually to be washed to the gulf in the current of the Rio Grande. In quiet moments, I devote my attentions to the local bird life. I listen for the call of the hermit thrush, one of the most gorgeous sounds in all of nature, a mellifluous warble beginning on a long, clear note. Dark-eyed juncos hop along the ground, searching for seeds among the grass and pine litter. With no one calling on the radio, I swim languidly in the waters of solitude, unwilling to rouse myself to anything but the most basic of labors. Brush teeth. Boil water for coffee. Observe clouds. The goal, if I can be said to have one, becomes to attain that state where I'm nothing but an eyeball in tune with cloud and light, a being of pure sensation. The cumulus build, the light shifts, and in an hour, Or is it two? I'm looking at country made new. Between 5 and 15 times a year, I'm the first to see a smoke. And once I've called it in, my superiors must choose a response. For most of the 20th century, the reaction was preordained, full suppression. A military mindset prevailed in the early Forest Service, and the results for America's public lands proved disastrous. Attacking every fire the moment it was spotted warped ecosystems that had burned on a regular basis for millennia. Retreating urbanites became convinced they could build their dream homes amid the forests with impunity. Smoke jumpers would float out of the sky and save the day if the call came. The fact remains that wildfire has a mind of its own, as we've learned the hard way. The lessons will only get harder in a warming world, but here on the Gila, officials are committed to making fire a part of the life of the forest again. They let certain lightning-caused fires burn for weeks at a time, making the Gila healthier than it would be otherwise, more diverse in the mosaic of its flora, more open in its ponderosa savanna, with less of the brushy ladder fuels that now make the American West an almost annual show of extreme fire behavior. With crews on the ground monitoring big blazes, I keep track of their movements and of wind shifts. I offer updates on fire behavior and smoke drift. I watch their weather when they sleep outside. I let them know when lightning is coming. I'm their eyes in the sky. There were once thousands of towers scattered across America, but only a few hundred are still staffed each summer. Some have predicted our impending obsolescence, thanks to better radio technology, more precise satellite imagery, perhaps even unmanned drones taking pictures on low-level flyovers, the never-ending dreams of the techno-fetishists. But in a place like the Gila, where so much of the country is rugged and remote, off limits to motorized equipment and new roads, lookouts are still the only communication link to the outside world for certain backcountry crews, at least for the time being. At around $13 an hour, we also remain far cheaper than aerial surveillance. Safety and fiscal prudence, these will be the saving graces of the lookouts who manage to hang on. Aldo Leopold, who drafted the proposal to preserve the Gila Wilderness in 1922, which his superiors promptly lost for 2 years, having misfiled it, a plan that made the headwaters of the Gila River the first place on Earth to be consciously protected from industrial machines, once wrote, "I am glad I shall never be young without wild country to be young in. Of what avail are 40 freedoms without a blank spot on the map?" Survey the lower 48 on a coast-to-coast flight, and the most interesting country never fails to be that without roads. Down there, amid one of those fragments of our natural heritage, is a forest that burns and a desert that dances. The view some days overwhelms me with its vastness, so I turn back to the earth beneath my feet. Wild candy tuft bloom under the pine and fir, followed later in the season by wallflowers, paintbrush, mountain wood sorrel, Mexican silene. On my evening rambles, I find Steller's jay and wild turkey feathers, snake skins and mule deer bones. Now and then, an hour of hunting turns up a relic in the dirt, not far from the base of my tower, a turquoise bead or a potsherd. Clearly, I am not alone in my communion here with sky. Far from it. The ravens and the vultures have me beat by 200 feet, the mogollons by most of a millennium. And who's to say the dust motes off the desert don't feel joy, if only for a moment, as they climb up into sky and ride the transport winds. Thank you.
is world-renowned botanist, Felger. And Richard is a researcher at the Herbarium and Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science.
Okay. Part of this is from a book, very small parts, from a book, Plant Life of a Desert Archipelago, Flora of the Sonoran Islands in the Gulf of California, University of Arizona Press, and eventually it'll be out, hopefully this year. The rest of this is mostly from a book in progress, and if you want to know when, the answer is soon. And the title is 10,000 Years of Field Notes. And you can all hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I've got a loud mouth. Okay, the title is Invasion, Desert, Archipelago, Planet. Fernando shows me a cave on the Hill of the Rooster where Moctezuma and Jesus met. Over there, by the morning glory trees along the Rio Yaqui, is where the Roman soldiers killed Jesus. But Fernando, that was more than 1,000 years before Europeans arrived. Tells me there's more than one reality. Panspermia was a hot topic among scientists in the 1700s and 1800s, and popularized 30 years ago by Sir Fred Hoyle and his student collaborator Chandra, and dismissed by mainstream science even into the 1990s. Panspermia. Seeds of life are everywhere, traveling between worlds. Microbial life on Earth may have come from Mars or even another star system. Alien-born life evolving into 10 million or more species. We may all be Martians. Behold the mighty water bear. Tardigrades, the world's toughest animals. In water and moist places, some are parthenogenic, asexually cloning, others sexually reproducing, soft and plump, less than a millimeter, waddling on stubby feet, eating bacteria, plant fluids, nematodes, rotifers, and smaller bears. Their own phylum, over 1,200 species known, must be many more. Gila forest water bears remain unstudied. Something good for all of you to think about doing. To 20,000 feet in the Himalayas, to below the sea, 13,000 feet deep, tropics to polar, they curl up and survive extremes that kill anything else. Freezing, boiling, years of desiccation, effectively dying and reviving. Minus 459 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just above absolute zero. To over 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Radiation 1,000 times more than any other animal. And surviving the vacuum of space. Tiny multi-organ creatures, far more complex than primordial life-forming molecules. They're everywhere on land, especially on mosses on land, probably even feeding on aquatic mosses like in Railroad Canyon in the Black Range. We're on Signal Peak. When my hiking friend takes his walking stick and whacks the top off a mullein, Verbascalum thapsus, damn non-native, from Eurasia now across North America, Silver City to the top of Signal Peak, large velvety leaves, some say good for arse wiping in the woods, but better a flat rock like an Indian. Listed as invasive, or is it just not native before Europeans? It's here to stay. I don't see it shoving anything out. White-haired, bright yellow flowers, and can grow as tall as I am in a single season. Mormon presents 99 ethnobotanical uses, medicinal, such as a stimulant to revive an unconscious person, or leaves smoked as tobacco, and Siberian elms, and ailanthus, called the tree of heaven in its native China, and the garbage tree in New York. Do you hate all newcomers? I walk along Railroad Canyon in the Black Range across an archipelago of drying, dying pools. One is water-brimmed. Green, submerged aquatic mosses shimmer in the early morning sun. Fontinalis hypnoides. I imagine all female water bear families sucking cell fluids from Fontinalis leaves. Water striders skittle across the surface. Who says you can't walk on water? In the next pool, the upper Fontinalis mosses are exposed and browning. And the next, less and less water, until the last X pool is bone dry. As a pool dries, the water striders and whirligig beetles and some water bears skip to the next most watered pool, like the archipelago of Gulf of California desert islands, from largest island of highest life diversity to smaller and ever more arid ones, down to a tiny birdshed island with only one plant species. Is our solar system an archipelago of life skipping from a drying, dying planet to a more habitable one? Or among archipelagos of solar systems and galaxies, the ever-expanding and shrinking music of the spheres, invaders from another tiny canyon pool, or from another continent, or another planet or galaxies? It's 12,000 years ago here. Time to move on again, 12,000 years ago. This place is stinking from our excrement and rotting carcasses and garbage. No more tasty giant land tortoises. And big mammals are onto our ways and run when we approach. Not much fun hunting animals so stupid you can walk right up to them and kill them, although amusing to torment and torture them, like enemy neighbors. The only way now to get an antelope is to chase a pregnant female until she wears out. Some young hunting friends and their women are moving on past distant, hazy mountains, even beyond where we scouted last year after our vision quest, not only because this place has come to stink, but to seek easier meat and get away from old women telling us how to behave. We're the first people into this pristine, verdant, animal-filled, watery river valley that you will call the Mimbres Valley. It's 1,000 years ago. We come into vacant lands where foolish farmers overpopulated, overexploited precious resources, cut trees until streams ran brown and then dry. Crammed into stinky little mud-walled, dark, dank rooms piled one on top of the other. We're smarter. We're hunters. We know when to move on. Our women know how to prevent too many kids. But some things are tough. When you get old and you can't keep up, we'll leave you behind with some water and a dog. Paul Martin's Pleistocene overkill model says we swept down from the Arctic to Tierra del Fuego in only 1,000 years, moving in a frontal wave, wiping out megafauna, naive to hunters. But those professors don't understand the three-letter word, F-U-N, the fun factor. Put that into your computer models. It's fun to hunt big animals, torment and torture them like our enemies. Our enemies, they talk funny and are stupid and try to take our land and don't deserve to live. And remember, everybody did this sort of thing, and some still do. Sweeping down ever-changing valleys and rivers wasn't the only way to come into the land. Some follow the sea, often in little reed boats, sometimes paddling to mysterious islands seen only from the shore. Some California islands had pygmy mammoths and tame sea otters, and other islands in the Gulf of California had tame deer and bighorn sheep. It's 1968. Maria Antonia Colosio, called Kunkai Mayor, elder old woman, tells the only first-hand account of a reed craft crossing the sea, sleek, slender craft called balsas, fashioned from giant reeds, rowed low in the water, and all aboard would be soaked. Maria Antonia describes a childhood trip from Tiburon Island to San Esteban Island in the early 20th century. We were on Callahoch. We were on two balsas tied together, side by side. We were going to, what's it called, the mountain out there in the sea. I didn't want to go. We were going to Coftacol, San Esteban Island. They had put blankets and water on. Pottery jugs as big as this were full of water, and they were tied in place. Plants were stuck in the mouths of the jugs to keep the water from spilling, and the jugs were put in carrying nets. I didn't want to get on, but my father caught me and put me on. After he caught me and put me on, he tied me behind a blind man who went along to paddle. I cried a lot, but he didn't pay any attention to me. That's how we went to Coftacol. It was so dangerous when we entered the area called Ixatoch, big water pool. The sea just swirled and churned. The wind wasn't blowing, but the water was choppy. It just churned. It was dangerous. Everything just roared. The children and old women all cried. The old man Posolis just said, "We'll land really soon." As we're going to land, he sang to the shore, and it seemed we landed right away. The men paddled with all their strength, and we landed near the rocks. It's 1539 by your calendar, 1539. Stories circulated even before foreigners arrived on their big first northward trespass. Strange humans on huge, snorting, deer-like tame animals. There were bad jokes about unnatural matings and strange anatomy. We thought the intruders might be a different species. Ones dressed in black and brown and making a big deal about the four cardinal directions seemed like bearded females. But the strangers were actually human, albeit deformed, depraved, immoral, and stupid, with disease-colored skin, way too much hair in the wrong places, and their stink was incredible. They did not speak properly, had no manners, were hungry even when food was all around, and did not bathe. We assumed they were primitive and not fully evolved. But the ridicule ceased when we learned how efficient they were at killing and their deadly diseases and terrifying war dogs. Amazing stories came from the people of the Red River Delta, where the intruders first landed in big boats. Again, 1539 by your calendar. Strange boats like living things, because the people saw their wings move, the sails. They could roar and kill like lightning. Island warriors tied inflated sea turtle bladders to their waist cords, and when the foreigners fired guns, they popped their turtle bladders. But the noise wasn't loud enough to kill the intruders. Even into the 18th century, animals are everywhere, always something to hunt and kill. Live rivers, marshes, and springs so common, nobody thinks wetlands are unusual. The Gila runs live with fish, cottonwoods, and willows all the way to the Red River, spreading into the immense delta. You seem to like rivers without water. Wide trails run along rivers like the ones the foreign trespassers used to come north. Even in summer, we can walk in shade and swim anywhere, drying off in speckle-shaded, hard-packed, smooth, damp ground. Pungent sea willow river smells, places of no spines. Beavers, otters, ducks, herons, cranes, egrets, turtles, frogs, and big fish, although you shouldn't eat certain ones. Living is easy along the rivers, although people are everywhere except mountaintops, where only the bravest go for visions. The big snake lives up there, crossing canyons without having to go down into the bottom. Hunters hear it moving around at night. Rivers and streams provide bouquets of fish, like the Colorado River squawfish, a 6-foot minnow. Your fishes are like rivers themselves, hanging on like the living dead. People in places like the Owens Valley diverted water into expansive shallow pools for little pupfish. Scoop them up in wide, soft, native hemp nets and dried as a staple. Owens Valley water went to Los Angeles, stranding the world's largest pupfish population. August 24, 1814. The Brits have just burned the White House. The copper mines, Minas de Cobre de Santa Rita, are too far from Mexico City to defend. And Apaches want settlers and miners to leave, but they stay like stink on shit. And the intruders' diseases killed more than half the people. Children and elders went first. After close encounters, we fumigated our houses and clothing with oily smoke from allthorn wood. Sometimes it seemed like the end, like the Moki or Hopi prophecies that the end will come when the foreigners put a house in the sky. When Jesus and Montezuma conferred at the Hill of the Rooster, only 250 million people lived on Earth. Nothing moved faster than a horse as European population ramped up and they made big boats to catch the wind and became invasive across the planet. Population waking up so sneaky. Machines invented, everything going faster. Our ancestors made do with living animals and plants, releasing energy no older than decades or perhaps a century by burning trees. Europeans scarfed geologic energy from coal and then oil to balance the demands of exponential population growth. Biomass balance. We displace the animals with more than 2.1 million every year, more than all of New Mexico, balancing all the animals gone. The universe requires balance. Negative entropy of people demands entropy, energy, balancing. Clubs, spears, and arrows, then guns and gunpowder. World population tops 2 billion. And cosmic energy is released over Nevada, Hiroshima, and Inuitok. Weaponry escalates lockstep with population. 7 billion, computer speeds double and redouble. Atomic stockpiles more than balance all of human negative entropy. Curiosity rover eats Mars dirt. That was the headline. Finds odd bright stuff. Engineers didn't have time to sterilize everything, like the dirt-eating drill bit. Probably not much chance to contaminate Mars. Probably. Engineers, not biologists, knowing what invasive species can do. 2042, Google Apple brings in a load of precious metal from a nearby planet, although they say it's from an asteroid. Proprietary information. Singapore stockholders demand better returns. Cut unnecessary sterilization. Free enterprise has to be efficient. 2049. I don't know how you got this information because there's nobody left alive. a microbe pre-adapted to feed on oxygen, nitrogen, and chlorophyll, hitched a ride on a Ghoul app space train. Some bacteria, blue-green algae, water bears, and nematodes survive.